Family Room Podcast, where I, Peter Squires, get to know your friends and neighbors. My family, they never knew. My family, they never knew.
My family. Welcome to the Family Room Podcast, getting to know your friends and neighbors. I'm Peter Squires. My guest on this episode is Chris Chase, owner and operator of the new Noise Floor Recording Studio in Dover. Chris and I talked about taking apart his old studio and building the new one, being a difficult teenager, fortuitous advice of a patient teacher, embracing learning, being a repo man, and the truth about Smash Mouth, among other things. Thanks for listening. Enjoy.
I am coming into the home stretch of completion. It's been a pretty massive, lengthy process in my shoes, in my opinion, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good. It's a studio. We're making some recordings in there.
Yeah.
I've started the beginning stages of a couple LPs. I've been doing some demos with some new clients that want to do a project either alone or bring in some other guest performers. So, you know, the wheels are turning. I've had some gremlins to chase out of the system, you know.
Yeah.
So it's good. I mean, I was hoping to have been done months ago, but in the grand scheme of the next, hopefully 10 to 20 years that I'm making music in there,
it'll feel like a blip on the radar.
Yeah.
How long were you without a studio between the spot in Rollinsford closing and then this one opening?
Basically like a year is what I would say, because I left there in September of 16. And then a good friend of mine, this guy, Greg Glasson, he's a local bass player, graphic designer, human being extraordinaire. He had like a home studio set up that he had built years ago. So he was gracious enough to be like, "Hey, I know you're in the middle of some projects, so come here." You know, he had a little booth. I left my studio. I took it apart. I disassembled like 70% of it, took it with me, which is now up in is the walls of the new space. So I was at Greg's for like 5-6 months. Did some vocals, did some guitar overdubs, finished, you know, mixed a few records there. And I was looking for places. I looked at about 60 properties.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was intense. It was intense. And then once I found this, it was 6 months. So, I mean, the first recording that I did in the new space was with Soggy Po' Boys.
Nice.
Which is cool. They're all good buddies. I've done 4 records with them. And it also pushed the studio to the extreme. Like, the first session was not, let's do drums or let's do the piano in the piano room alone and see. It was like, let's do 7 people. Let's do 20 inputs. Let's just see what the hell this thing does.
Yeah. It's like, I just learned to swim. Where's the diving board? I'm going off the high dive.
Yeah, totally. So I was, you know, basically with that one till for a year, because that Soggy Po' Boys thing in September was like almost a year to the date from when I like dismantled my other one.
Wow.
Like, I worked up until, I don't know, 4 or 5 days before I had to leave, before my lease was up, and worked until that point and was like, okay, pull the plug and let's start taking this baby apart, you know?
Wow. That must have been a lot of work.
Yeah.
I saw the like videos you were posting of assembling the new studio and like putting the floor down and stuff like that. Like, it seems like there's a lot of build out that has to happen. You can't just like go into a room and be like, all right, good enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of did that in the last one. Did you ever go to the last place?
I never recorded there, but I went there when we were talking about setting up the,
that's right,
the gear swap.
That's right.
We met up there.
So like that place, the only room that I like built out in any sense, robust manner, was the control room.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the 2 ISO booths and the entranceway, they were all single wall construction. It was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
So there was nothing crazy about it. And, there wasn't, I mean, I made records there for 5.5 years, but there was not, true isolation. You know, if you had a horn player in one booth and a drummer on the other side in the live room, yeah, you're going to hear those hi-hats and you know, it, but I come from a school of thought of you can make a record anywhere. And if there's bleed, how do you negate it or how do you use it?
Right.
How do you engineer your way through it? Because, you know, a good song, a good performance, you can have one mic and you just, I have a mono or stereo track. How do I EQ or compress this to sound the best or bring out the most in instrument? So, you know, I made records there for 5.5 years. It wasn't perfect. So I feel bad for anybody that has to take apart this new space in you know, 20 years or something. Cause yeah, this, when I decided to do this one, I mean, I was basically out. I was frustrated at looking for spaces. And then I found this one and it worked for me and I guess my vision. So, but I decided, I was like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I have to do it right. Like I had a lot as an engineer, I had a lot of gripes about my last studio. I mean, the vibe was cool. Musicians really enjoyed it, responded well to it, which is ultimately what I think was important and made it successful in whatever, you know, way you measure that. But this new one, I was like, I'm not going to half-ass it. If I'm going to build a studio, I want to build a studio that I and hopefully many other engineers will be happy to call home and feel creative and want to hunker down there and make some magic, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a much different build process than the last one. And I gauged it wrongfully on my last build, which took me about 3 months. And so I sort of thought like, okay, I'm really ambitious and really excited. So I'll do this one in 3 months, you know? And no, it was six.
Yeah.
You know? That's a lot of work.
I mean, that's probably like a good rule of thumb. Like to, in your less ambitious moment, be like, all right, whatever I thought it was going to be, let's double it.
Yeah. You know, I built the whole place myself and, you know, I know enough to be dangerous. I'm certainly not a wonderfully fine-tuned craftsman, you know. I built some built-ins kind of similar to this, which was the first time I had done something like large of that scale, which was a wonderful learning experience to be like, holy cow, that's how you do that thing?
Yeah.
Okay, I messed that up. Let's take it down and do it again. Yeah, I mean, it was intense. It was a lot of work and doing it like myself, you know, it's not like, okay, I have a plan. I come in next week and this crew has done this thing, you know? So everyone along the way, luckily I have a lot of friends that are skilled. And so what I did get is a lot of support, people coming in and being like, cool, you're openly talking about how you'd like to do X, Y, and Z. Here's my opinions as a professional in this field. So I got a lot of good free advice, which in the end saved me a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, doing certain processes that I'd never done. So having a dude that's done it 1,000 times be like, this is exactly how you do this. So when you do it, if you don't do it this way, you're doing it incorrectly.
Right. And just so you know.
And it will take you more time.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
How long were you in the studio in Rollinsford?
So I was there for 6 years to the date, and I was making records for 5.5, basically.
Wow. And you already have you've already been recording in the new space, and like, do you already have a bunch of more stuff lined up in there?
Yeah, yes and no. So I have I wouldn't say a plethora. I have a flotilla of some clients. Like I'm working on a cool record with John McCormick right now. He's got a project called Paintbox, which is it's a concept record that has been evolving throughout different iterations have been evolving sort of throughout the process. We've been working on it for like a year and a half. So we tracked everything. At the last place, sans some vocals and stuff like we did at Greg's house. But him and I made the decision like, okay, let's mix this in the new room. And he has another batch of tunes that's coming along. They're going to go with this. So we're not sure how it's going to be packaged, presented, single disc, double disc, 2 releases staged. Who knows? He's looking at possibly putting a stage show together for the release rather than like a concert or two CD release. So anyway, so, you know, that's a project that's been in the works, which is cool because I built this new room, this engineer, you know, highly engineered control room. So to be able to push up faders on a project that I knew I did in the old space, I know what it sounds like. I listened to it a lot in Greg's space, you know, which wasn't a pro built studio, but it at least gives you feedback,
right?
You know, sonic feedback on what's going on. so, you know, that's going on. That's been cool. That's been great for me to put my hands on in the room. I've got a couple of singer-songwriters that are newer clients that are doing some EPs, which is cool. I've got a couple other clients that are doing second or third records with me. But a lot of that, you know, gets sprinkled out. Like, hey, man, I want to book time, so I'll see you in February. See you in April. So there is stuff coming in, but there is certainly a lot of time that I'm, you know, I haven't started marketing. I haven't started reaching out. I mean, I've just slowly been coming into the landing of like, oh, I'm done. Yeah. I can do the other things that I need to do to run this business now. So, yeah, I mean, you know, my guess is that in the rest of this calendar year, there's going to be some time available. So I'm thinking of ways to fill it, whether it's, you know, do we reach out to some bands that we like and just offer a screaming deal rather than have the room sit empty? Mm-hmm. Do I do that to some other engineers? Just say, hey, man, you know, you want to have a place to make some records? Come in and do one super cheap. See what the room feels like. Because, I mean, ultimately my goal is, you know, year two, year three, something like that. I don't want to be the dude sitting in the chair hitting the red button all the time. I love it. I absolutely love it. I wouldn't have labored over this if I didn't, you know. You know, for me, I think that it's hard when I was recording 50 weeks a year to be creatively committed, you know, both to myself and clients. There were some projects where it's like you start the process and I'm up at night, I'm listening to your demos, I'm sending you emails, we're doing this together, we're really digesting it. And then all of a sudden I got three or four of those going on, you know, something's going to give. Either I'm not going to sleep or somebody's not going to get the same attention that somebody else gets. And so I never, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think I ever upset a client or made them feel second best to somebody else.
Right.
You know, if I did, I certainly apologize.
You would have heard about it.
Yeah, I would imagine so, yeah. Somebody's pissed at you.
Yeah.
That record sucks.
It's way too small of a town for you not to have heard about it.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I'd like to actually, you know, be able to focus a couple years from now, like, hey, I'm going to produce 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 records a year max. So I really like the idea of, you know, you get in, you do it. Like, you, whether it's a weekend or a month, like, we go in and we do this record and it's done. We don't put it on the shelf and have email chains about what we're going to do, we're going to add. No, you go into that room, you have a vision, you kick it out and you let it go. You know what I mean? Like, you.
Yeah. That's one of the things that, like, I actually can, I have the opposite problem where I don't let stuff marinate at all. I'm just like, ooh, I wrote a song, I'm going to go record it myself and then like hastily release it on Bandcamp, where I should be like, that should be the demo. And then I should be like polishing it.
Well, who cares then? I mean, like,
yeah.
So what, but you released it. You
no, it's good. I like doing it that way. It's fun because it's like the journey from like the birth of the idea to the like delivery of it is just like so fast. But then what I would like to at least try to do is that sort of like, all right, this was step one. Now, like, how can I make this the best version of it that it'll be, and like come up with a plan rather than just like shitting it out, you know?
Yeah.
But when I hear about someone who has a thing that they worked on for a month that's been sitting on the shelf for a year or two, I'm like, that would drive me insane.
Yeah.
You know, where I feel like it would be keeping me from starting whatever else I could be doing.
Oh man. You know, it's funny because, there's a couple of key players in this, local scene. I won't mention any names, but they're rather prolific and they write a lot for a lot of different projects. And so there have been periods where I would be leapfrogged on 2 or 3 records, you know, with these creative forces. And I'm like saying to them, we need to finish that other record.
Yeah.
Because we're going to start this other one in 2 months. And once we start it, that will take priority for a year. And
yeah,
every project is different. And every, you know, every budget, every client is different. The creative approach is different. Meaning sometimes people come in and they want to just like incubate, grow organically, adapt in the room. We have a song, we have a structure, let's see what happens. Other people, it's charted, you know, we're playing it, or this is memorized to a T. We're walking in, you know, ready to go. You know, nothing changes. We're solid on this. We've done our pre-production at home, whatever. So every record is totally different, but I still feel like either end of that spectrum, like you have some ideas or some players or some strong song structures, but you kind of want to grow. You know, if you set up in a studio in a traditional sense where like you all take a week or two off from work, or it's planned in a way that, you know, you can be there 8 or 10 hours and still work, and a room is set up, like you could record 15, 16 hours a day. So, right. If 8 of those hours are spent writing a tune and crafting it and having coffee and being like, man, what do we do to this bridge or whatever? It's not wasted time. You know, you're working on that craft. And I've been in those situations where you're there and you're just doing it. So whether it's fully ironed out and now we just need to execute, or whether it's, hey, we got some tunes and then we've got some open-ended stuff. Let's work through it. Let's finish some stuff. You know, I've seen both of those just yield great results, you know?
Yeah.
So it's hard. I mean, like, you know, financially and scheduling wise, making records like that in a traditional sense, I think is hard. So I embrace, you know, modern stuff. Hey man, people do stuff at home, whether they come in with stuff that we build from or whether they demo at home and we start fresh and then I send them off and they overdub at home. You know, some clients, hey, I want to track with you. We'll mix at home. So all of that's different. What I mean is, you know, the projects that I think I want to take on, like I'm going to take home with me and love and nurture and care about.
Yeah, own it. Yeah, yeah. Care about.
Like I want to, that's the true sense of producing. You know, a lot of people today, I think, consider themselves producers and some rightfully and some not, you know. So to me, the true sense of producing it is not just like, oh, I had an idea with this band and we found a room and have at it, guys. You know, I mean, it's like, what's the vision here? How do we extract that vision in the best possible way, you know? So I want to do less of that. Like I want to do less and have it be sort of things that I care about, whether it's people that approach me that I'm like, yeah, I'm on fire for your music, or vice versa, people that I seek out and say, hey, I love what you're doing. You know, you want to try and make something together.
Yeah. You know? And then you have a life outside of the recording studio, totally. You know, where like you can also like as a business owner, you can actually invest, you can feel passionate about that without just being totally like myopic about it, totally, and get like easily burned out, you know, and have it like take attention away from other things that are important to you in your life. You know?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, life is a learning experience. Yeah. I'm still on that train. Yeah. You know, part of this whole build and new business, you know, because it's a new business. I've got a couple of partners. You know, the catalyst was me leaving the studio, and I had this guy Dan King, who is a client and good buddy, longtime friend, who has some gear and had some equipment, and you know, is a musician, is a player, and also dabbles in engineering. He was interested in partnering up, and so that was. When I left, I was looking through that lens of, okay, you know, let's find a space that works for both of us. But he's in Massachusetts, so, you know, we looked in Amesbury and Epping a little bit, and Brentwood, Stratham, you know, trying to get closer. I was adamant about keeping it in New Hampshire, though. You know, part of the new business was like, okay, I have a son. I'm a full-time dad. So, you know, 8 to 3:30, what do I do? How do I make records 8 to 3:30? So, the reality is part of that is doable because, you know, making a record is not always the warm bodies in the room. It's one or two minds, you know, in a control room, critical listening, you know, editing, doing production, mixing, pardon.
Is that your ring all year round or just
that is my ring all the time. Yeah. I get a lot of flack for that because people are like, what is that? Is that aliens? Is that a theremin? And, it's funny because for a long time, I, you know, used to just have like a single ping.
Uh-huh.
And you know, when I'm tracking or mixing a single ping, it's lost in a beat
totally,
and it's gone. And so right around the time that, My son was born. This is the longest ringtone that the iPhone has, meaning it's continuous for like 40 seconds. So there would be times where mid take or I'm on the talk back and all of a sudden it's like, what is that? Oh, it's my phone.
So, sorry.
out of the context of that room, people are like, why is that your ringtone? That is the most obnoxious thing.
Well, now it's like, I don't know. I saw Dr. Gasp the other night, so it seems totally appropriate.
Totally. Totally. How was that, by the way?
Amazing. Yeah. As always.
I was kind of bummed. I was hoping to bring my son, and I had a little man date night with Hislop and his son Willie.
Nice.
At Umani. And, you know, we got caught up in some heated foosball. So we were there a little bit longer than expected, and it was going to be a past his bedtime scenario anyway.
Yeah.
We went to Book and Bar. But I was corresponding with FNUF, and you know, he's telling me the time they're going to take the stage. I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to drag my little dude out.
I mean, the good thing about Dr. Gasp is every year you have plenty of opportunities to catch him.
Yeah,
you know?
So, totally.
Oh, no, it was great. So how did you get into, like, engineering in the first place?
Well, I don't know, man. I have, like, kind of a weird growth or path, I guess, from it. Like when I was a freshman in high school, I went to Exeter, and at Phillips Exeter Academy, they have a radio station, and part of whatever their FCC, I don't know, accreditation or license or whatever, part of it has to be accessible to the public. So I guess how they appeased that was by having a couple of Exeter public school kids having a few shows. So essentially this guy that was friends with one of my older brothers had a show for his whole high school tenure, this kind of like ska reggae show. So he passed it down to me. You know, he knew I was into ska and reggae at the time. So he's like, hey, I'm going to leave. Do you want to come do these intern hours under me, learn how to be a DJ, do these things? I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. That sounds cool. So I did. And I had a show for 2 years, which was, or a year and a half, cause I apprenticed for, you know, the first half of the first year of my freshman year. But it was cool. I felt connected to music in a different way that I never had. You know, like playing a song and having kids my age call in, like, who was that? What was that?
Yeah.
What's going on? It felt different to me. And I went a little overboard. I was quite a, I don't know, eccentric asshole at that age, to put it bluntly, kind of like don't give a fuck attitude. My DJ name was DJ Dickie Smalls, and I changed the name of the ska show to Only Bum the Best because I had seen it in this American Spirit ad in Rolling Stone. I thought it was hilarious. So, yeah, I was pretty like flamboyant and cavalier about being a dick. I swore on air, and the school got in trouble and fined, but
really?
Like, yeah. Cause you know, you're not supposed to swear. And I said, fuck a couple times. And
I mean, I've always wondered who monitors that? Is it just like audience monitored?
Well, so this kid, you know, like I do the show and it had a time slot. I think it was like 6:30 to 8, on Thursday nights. And so, this kid, this, you know, PEA student was supposed to monitor. And so he's out there and like, I think it must've been the second week or something, you know, cause the first week I was so nervous and, you know, people at school were like, oh, we listened to your show. It was awesome. So, you know, the next week I sort of went in with a head on my shoulders and was like, this is cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
I guess I got a little carried away and I swore, and the kid told me, he's like, you can't do that. And then the following week, same thing. And it just, you know, I'm saying fuck as like a passing tone within my sentence.
Totally. Yeah.
And he's like, I can't say that. So finally the kid just stopped showing up. Like, he's supposed to sign off on I was here or whatever. So I don't know what was up in that dude's life.
So, but basically it was like, I'm not going to fire you, but I can't be accountable for this.
I can't be accountable. I'm not going to be here saying, you know, whatever. I signed off on your show.
Right.
So I didn't hear a word for, I don't know, months. I mean, I continued to do my show, and then, you know, an adult authority figure was like, by the way, somebody listened, made a complaint, whether it was like a parent, you know, that complained, I don't know, you know, that wasn't clear, but so anyway, I mean, that was different for me. Like I wasn't really a musician at that point. I was playing saxophone, but I wasn't like a true musician. You know, I was a music listener, So that changed it for me. I felt like the way that music resonated with me was resonating with people in a different way. I guess, you know, I'm a teenager. I'm coming to terms with my own identity.
Yeah.
And what what art, culture, everything means to me, you know? So yeah, that sort of like, I guess, thrust me into at least a different world besides a listener and or musician.
Yeah.
You know, in this sort of technical ethos, you know, vapor barrier of weirdos like me that live behind the scenes, you know,
yeah.
And then, you know, I took music more seriously and I played and I was in bands, you know, as a teenager, and then I didn't go to college. I graduated and had a very fuck the world attitude, like, you know, I'm just going to work and I'm going to do me and nobody's going to tell me that I have to do this American thing and go to school and get into debt. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. So yeah. I was like, I'm not doing that. Well, actually, no, I'll backtrack like a year. So I'm like, senior year humanities class, you have to do this job shadow. And again, I was just a dick, you know, bleach blonde hair, chain wallet.
Yeah.
Just like, I am too cool for school, literally.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? Like, I don't fucking know. Well, you have to do this project. What do you want to do? I want to be a record producer. It just comes out of my mouth. Well, what does that mean? I have no idea, ma'am. Okay. Well, if you're going to do this project on that, go figure it out.
Yeah.
Find out what that means.
So much of being a good teacher must just be not getting flustered when teenagers are being assholes. You know, like I still heard you say that even if you're being a dick.
Yeah.
Like, I like to not get your feathers ruffled by the delivery and to like find the moment of authenticity that is like in there somewhere.
You know? I can't even remember her name. Side note, my high school was weird. Cause I went to Exeter, like, you know, kindergarten through 10th grade. Yeah. And we moved to Lee. So I went to Orchard River my junior and senior year. And at the time I was dating a girl from Exeter.
Yeah.
Who became a freshman at UNH. So here I am, a junior. She's a freshman. I'm like, I don't care about any of you people. I don't need to make friends here. I'm going to finish school. I'm going to hang out with my girlfriend every day after school. Like, none of this matters. We broke up, you know, beginning of my senior year, like week one. So it's like, oh man, I'm a senior in a school. I don't know anybody.
Huh.
Okay. Weird. You know? Yeah. And again, bleach blonde hair, chain wallet. Like I was the new guy.
Right.
Like, who is this dude? So yeah, you know, I want to be a record producer. She's like, you know, okay, go figure it out. So, literally just went home. Was like, I don't know. My brother's a huge music fan, connoisseur. He's an encyclopedia of shit. He's like, well, you know, you like this kind of music and these kind of people. Like, maybe you can write a paper on like Rick Rubin or something, or, you know, Butch Vig or something. And okay, go back to teacher. No, it's a job shadow. Can you reach out and touch these people? No. Well, then go find somebody you can reach out and touch. So this family friend was a horn player, this guy, Mark Paquin. And he had, you know, semi-mentored me in my asshole adolescence, you know, be a better dude, achieve more, stop being a dick kind of shit.
Stop cursing on the radio.
Exactly. He was in like, he was in Bim Scala Bim at the time when I was doing the radio show. And so like it ignited this weird thing where I was doing this radio show and he was in that, and he played with like the Boston's and New York Ska Jazz Ensemble and Toasters and a bunch of bands, you know, in like the mid to late 90s. And so, you know, he dragged me along to a bunch of shows going backstage. You know, I'm just like, this is awesome. This is so cool.
Yeah.
You know, this is it. This is what I'm going to be. So I asked him, I'm like, how do I become a music producer? He's like, well, you know, you gotta know how to engineer. You gotta know how to speak that language. And, you gotta have a vision. You gotta understand musicians. You gotta understand the art, you know, like all this ethereal stuff to me as a semi-closed minded teenager, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also just stuff that you had never actually experienced. Like when you listen to a CD or whatever, or hear a song on the radio, you're not really thinking about the sort of like, either the technical expertise that went into making that happen, or B, the human experience of what it feels like to be in a recording studio.
Totally.
What it takes to go from a, like, coming up with like a lick on your saxophone to putting out a record that's then in someone's hands thousands of miles away that they play on a radio station.
Yeah, right? Totally. I mean, there, like, none of that was tangible to me. Yeah. It was just black magic. And totally. I didn't grow up listening to a lot of secular music. You know, my parents were pretty religious, and so I thought Peter, Paul, and Mary was the shit until I was like 12. Yeah. And I was like, oh, man, I guess show tunes aren't cool. Don't sing those in the lunchroom. That's real talk. Did you, that's did why you I'm
learn,
scarred.
Did you learn that lesson the hard way?
Oh, I totally did. I mean, I remember having a couple of buddies and, you know, like, we all listened to show tunes when we were like second, third, fourth grade. Yeah. Some of us did like musical theater together, whatever. And then you get to that point where you're like talking about a song from Rent in the locker room and your buddy's like, you fucking loser. What are you talking about? You know, yeah. Just like, what, dude? We were singing Cats the other day, man. You know, like,
totally.
Like, no.
I remember having that moment with action figures where, like, and I kind of like, I feel like a jerk.
Have you met my brother Scott? A little you guys bit. Would probably hold a hands and bit. Cry together. I know. Just like deep eye contact.
I had this friend, Toby, and Toby was like my, like, watch cartoons, play with action figures, like, we're still dorky kids together. And then it was like seventh grade maybe, and I became friends with this girl, Nicole, who was like beautiful and cool, and like, she's the one who was like, you're cool too, but you have to stop wearing sweatpants to school and here, listen to this CD. And then just like going, shifting, like,
don't you pay me
hard
that box.
Left turn from Toby to Nicole, you know what I mean? And then it was just like, and then like Toby's mom calling my mom being like, why doesn't Peter want to be friends with Toby anymore? And I was just like, it's nothing personal. I'm on this new shit.
Yeah. You know? They're called girls. Yes. I don't know if you've noticed them.
She has an intense power over me that I can't quite explain yet, but I'm going to stop wearing sweatpants to school.
Yep. Yep. That's a good life. Thanks, Nicole.
Yeah.
Good life lesson there.
Wherever you are.
Yeah. So I basically, you know, called Mark, Hail Mary, help me. How do I do this?
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, this guy, Chris Magruder, just built this studio in his barn in South Berwick, you know, go check it out. And so, you know, I called him, hey, I got to do this internship. And he's like, no way, kid. You know, I got clients, they're paying. Nope. Come on. So I went back to Mark. I'm like, nah, he said no. So Mark was like, all right, well, I have a session coming up there. So I'll tell Chris and you can show up for that. Okay. So I do, and I sit, and I'm a fly on the wall, and I don't know what any of this stuff is. You know, he had a console and, you know, some outboard gear, and I didn't know what any of that shit was, you know, and it was boring. To me, it was boring. So I sat there for a session. They did some horn overdubs, and, you know, I didn't say a word, so I guess I passed the test. He's like, okay, you know, come back on this other day, because I was like, I want to make rock, you know. I'm like, how do you make rock? I play sax, but I'm bored in a four-hour horn overdub session, you know. Right. I come back to another session and he's doing drums and, you know, again, I was bored because, you know, all right, let's string up 10 mics and, you know, go through the scratch test. Now let's get sounds and let's build headphones and, you know, the things that I do now every day.
Right.
I was like, oh, this is boring. And then he was doing something and I don't know what he was doing. You know, he's using, come to find out, you know, he was using a particular compressor that I'm, wildly in love with to this day. But it just, you know, these drums just turned into drums.
Hmm.
Like what sounded like a record-ish drum, yeah. You know, to me. So what the fuck was that? You know, and I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know the process, the language, you know, the science or whatever. So he just kind of brushed it off. Like, you want to learn, go buy some equipment.
Hmm.
You know, we're here in the computer age, buddy. I mean, this was 2000. You know, go buy a computer and try this. So at the time I did, I, you know, probably right after I graduated, bought a computer and a little two-track, you know, USB 1 interface.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be damned, that fucker was the bane of my existence for like a year and a half because it would work and then it wouldn't work and it would work and it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, this was a, you know, a 2000 era computer and device. And I was in bands and I was trying to like track them live at concerts, whatever. And I couldn't do it. I
mean, yeah.
I couldn't figure it out. Couldn't do it. Sometimes it would work and be like, that was fucking great.
Yeah.
And the next time, like, what the fuck? Because yeah. I didn't know. I was self-taught. And again, this was new. So it wasn't like you get on a chat or a forum right then and there. And there's 100 people that have had the same problem. I'm like, barely finding information out about this troubleshooting,
right?
You know, via my dial-up at the time, whatever.
Well, it's funny to think of the internet not being this thing that was everywhere and the thing that everyone used, you know? Like, it was all so basic, like, even for a couple of years after it reached that point where, like, everyone was using it, where it was, like, everything just moved so much more slowly. You know, you had to, like, really seek stuff out. Like, Google didn't exist yet.
Oh, totally.
The internet wasn't just this, like, easily searchable thing.
Yeah.
It was, like, weird, dark alleyways.
Yeah. I mean, how old are you? Like, early 30s?
I'm 36.
Okay, so I'm 35, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, like, same era. Yeah. And, I mean, yeah, like, my whole high school tenure, you didn't ask the internet anything.
It's no.
Like you go to the fucking library totally. Or you talk to a teacher.
Well, and the internet was for like chat rooms.
Totally. You know? Oh man. Yeah. I mean, I used a computer exclusively for AOL chat and downloading everything I could find on Napster.
Yeah.
Every goddamn thing. I mean, I crashed two of my mother's, you know, desktop computers before she was like, cool, go buy your own. Break that, you know? Yeah. I mean, it was a much different world then for sure. Everything did move slowly. I would go down to record stores and buy records and also look at the back of records that, okay, I don't know this band, but this guy did it. So do I take that chance?
Right.
You know? It was so different then, you know, than it is now, which is, I feel old saying that, but
it's true. I mean, it's a huge, like during a really, like formative time of our lives, the world went through an enormous shift, like especially like in Western culture, you know, like it's just like it's hard to remember life before this shift happened, even though it wasn't that long ago.
Totally.
You know, but it was huge. I mean, I think for me, it kind of like coincided with going to college. So it was almost like, oh, in college, there's this thing called the internet. You know what I mean? But it was just sort of like the timing of it worked out that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard to imagine, like, how did people communicate and learn how to do things before that? It just took a lot longer.
Yeah.
You know, you had to know people and you had to call people, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like instead of asking the internet, you'd be like, who do I know that is good at hockey and I've got this question. What tape do I buy for this thing? I'll go ask the guy that has done that.
Or I'll go to the library.
Or go to the library. Yeah. You know, like how do I make this cut? How do I do this thing? You know, like, and now, like you said, it's all over the world. So you have that question quite literally at the same exact time you're having that question. I bet somebody else around that planet is also having it.
Yeah.
They're either putting their own video up or referencing, you know, the same video. It's wild and crazy. Right?
So you apprentice?
I wasn't really apprentice. It was just like I sat there for like three sessions, I think, and he was like, "Go buy gear." And I went and I bought gear, and I wasn't trying to do it as a trade. I was just like, "Oh, cool! I bought gear. I'm staring at a computer, and I'm trying to learn digital audio, you know." And at the time, my mom was like, "You know, I had been out of school. I had graduated like 2 or 3 years, maybe." At that point, my mom's like, "Come on. Go to college. You've blown off some steam, you know, you chased girls, you got drunk, you played shows, like, cool. Like, what do you want to do? This is a thing you're passionate about. Like, are you serious about it?" So my mom had actually found a couple of these like audio programs, a couple schools that were like 2-year associates. She's like, "What do you think?" And I was like, "Man, that's actually pretty badass, you know, like, cool. I saved the brochures from when you did that thing senior year of high school.
Right.
Thanks, mom.
Yeah.
For being mom. Just pulled it out of mom drawer, you know?"
It's such a funny, transition that you have to go, that everyone hopefully goes through at some point, but it's usually like after high school, I think, when you realize that the idea of learning something doesn't have to be dreadful.
Oh,
you
man.
Know,
yeah.
That learning, it's like, oh, I'm excited to learn how to do that rather than just like, fuck learning. Like, that's my least favorite thing to do, you know?
Yeah, it's funny because I was very anti-knowledge, basically, growing up. It's funny because I'm going through this now with my child, who's a wonderful and stubborn little human being. You know, I just, cool. If you're teaching me, I'm seeing you as an authority figure, and I don't do well with authority figures,
right.
You know? So, yeah, I thought learning was for the birds, which, you know, I mean, I almost walked in high school. I was like, I don't care. I don't care about a piece of paper.
Right.
I'm going to go do whatever I need or want to do to earn, you know, a livelihood. And again, just being cocky 16, 17 year old. I know what I'm doing. Luckily, my mom talked me off that ledge of not, you know, just throwing it up, throwing my hands up. Like, I don't want to wake up in the morning. So fuck a diploma. Who cares? I'll go work at a gas station. Really? Yeah. That's your aspiration? Yeah, right now sounds all right. You know, fuck it.
Yeah.
So luckily it didn't go that path. I did work at a gas station at some point in my life, but
the romance of it faded quickly.
Exactly. Yeah. I jumped from a gas station to just strictly convenience store. Didn't have to deal with the petrol. So my mom was, you know, encouraged, like, hey, do this thing, go to this school. So I did. So I, you know, applied, got in, you know, had, you had to send recordings, you had to get, recommendations, you know, from people. So, you know, luckily I had a couple contacts, you know, doing real things in the audio industry. So, you know, got some recommendations, sent in some stuff that I recorded, had to figure out how to get some better recordings for the application process, you know? So I went and just, it was just a 2-year associates, but I loved it. I'd been out of school for 4 years. So I soaked it up.
Yeah.
I was like, give me everything. I was the kid, the dude in class. It's like, hey, can we elaborate on that?
Okay. Where was the school?
It was in Tempe, Arizona. It's called the Conservatory of Recording Arts.
Cool.
Yeah, it was. Tempe was cool. Phoenix broadly is basically hell on earth. I don't recommend anybody go there or buy property there because it's not a sound thing to do.
No.
Oh, that place is fucked, dude. That place. I have many sideways stories of shit that I witnessed firsthand in the 2 years that I was there.
Yeah. Just dried out meth country kind of a thing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I had this fucked up job. To this day, it's the most money I ever made, per hour. So I apply to school, get in, you know, I'm going to go in a year. So I, what am I going to do? How do I make the most money in this next year before I go to school and basically don't work for 2 years? So, I worked for a buddy doing telecommunication shit and I wanted to take a nap on the train tracks immediately. I was like, this is not for me.
Yeah.
I can't put on a suit and tie. I can't sit through board meetings. I hate all of this. So, but it was my buddy and I wasn't going to just walk out with my middle finger in the air. I'm like, told him day two. I was like, I need out. So how do I do this without fucking you, the worst? You know? He's like, give me like 60 days. Like, fuck, you gotta be kidding me.
That's a lot of days.
There's a lot of days. Yeah. And I was driving to Hampstead. A lot of those days it was awful. So I ended up taking a job doing tree service, and made, you know, relatively good money. You know, it was a dangerous job, so I was adequately compensated, I would say. So I moved to Arizona, and in the back of my mind, I'm like, yeah, you know, I'll get a job. Maybe not as much, but I'll get a, you know, $12, $13 an hour job, something like that. No. You know, it's a right-to-work state, and everything there is just big box stores.
Hmm.
Like there is no small business.
Right.
Like in Tempe, you know, it's all Phoenix Valley, you know, so much like Boston or New York, you know, you have like the city proper and then you just have all these other, you know, little towns that are just 2, 3, 4, 8 blocks outside, you know what I mean? So Tempe is a little cooler. There's some older independent stuff, but majority of all of Phoenix Valley is just like big business.
Yeah.
Shit. So it's like, cool. I want you to be the night manager at this hotel at a Ramada for $7.25 an hour. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you kidding me? Like everything I applied for, cool. $6.80 an hour, $7 an hour, $7.20 an hour. So, you know, I had a little bit of money and saved a little bit. Anyway, I ended up applying to this place that was kind of like a daddy's. This place called Milano's Music. And at any given point, you know, they had like 12 locations. At any given point, they had like 180,000 instruments rented out in Phoenix Valley, you know, like high school band instruments. So I kept applying. And this guy finally one day was like, dude, we'd love to hire you. Because I'm like, I have drum experience. I have sax, woodwind experience. I have recording experience. I'm in school for this program now, you know. And the guy's like, sorry, dude, I have this policy. I don't hire anybody after September 30th. For the Christmas season, you know, like I want my people to know what the fuck they're doing. So he was like, do you want to be a repo man? I'm like, no. He's like, okay. I go back in a week later and I'm like begging this
fine,
guy.
Yeah.
No, I was like, come on. Like, just come on. I will learn. I will stay up. I will be trained. I will prove to you. I need a fucking job, man.
Yeah.
He's like, dude, why don't you go talk to this girl, Amy, about being a repo man? I'm like, fine. So I go talk to her. She's like, you know, I'm not a big dude, right? So she's like, hey, you basically knock on people's doors and you either collect payment or collect the instrument. It's like, that sounds really awkward. I'm not into that. She's like, you can make like $300 a day. I was like, I'm going to do that right now. So I did. I drove. I was like gangbusters. She would give me a stack of like a couple hundred delinquent accounts at a time that would be like within a particular radius.
Yeah.
Like I will drive 2 blocks and knock on 40 doors.
Right.
You know, in these apartment complexes and shit. So I ended up over the 2 years I was there just like clearing a bunch of accounts and spreading out to where I would get out of school, go drive 40 miles, and then go in those neighborhoods 40 miles away. So I saw just a lot of fucked up shit. There was a lot. I mean, and by a lot, I mean hundreds upon hundreds of development projects, not just like one or two gone bad. I mean, hundreds upon hundreds of development projects that had been started and had been bankrupt during the process. So here you've got a cul-de-sac of 60 houses that are all framed and two of them are finished and people are living in it and it's worth zero to them, but they bought up front and they're there. Some of them, you know, electricity and water wasn't run and the house is finished and these people are on the hook for that mortgage and the bank is throwing their hands up because the developer didn't run sewage, you know, because the developer never talked to the town. And like it's like Wild Wild West where it's like whoever could build it and grease the town first, you know, they're going to get access to these basic human needs, you know. So it was fucked. And it's just, you get further out, no offense, you know, there's a stereotype of like the kind of people that are living in these outskirts, you know, like they want to be left alone. So I knocked on some very interesting doors and had some very interesting experiences and conversations.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, so was it most often people would give you the money or that they'd give you back the instrument?
Most often than not, they didn't answer the door, and they were home. But it didn't matter to me because the pay scale was almost in my benefit to show up twice and leave a tag, which I would get paid. I think it was like $10.50 or $11 the first tag. So if I go out and just leave 30 tags, okay, I made $300.
Huh?
You know. So then the second time it was like $4 or $5 for a tag. And then the third time it's zero, but you know, if I got the instrument or if I got payment, I got a percentage of either. And so a lot of the times it would be like, you know, somebody just forgot, or hey, you know, mom or dad went to jail or went back to Mexico or they died or,
right,
you know, so-and-so got divorced and ran away. So like a lot of times it would be, you know, whatever misunderstanding, you know, oh my gosh, little Susie hasn't played that in 2 years. It's under her bed. I will give it back to you right now. Do I still owe you? I mean, I had some, you know, parents, you know, usually moms that would be like, oh my gosh, I'm embarrassed. Here's the instrument and I want to clear the balance, you know? And then you'd have people that'd be like, I don't know where that is. I haven't seen that. Okay. Well, unfortunately it's going to be bad debt in your name, but it was weird because the state, Arizona, has some pretty off kilter laws. turns out, and the federal government steps in sometimes and puts down their own borders, regulations, limitations on it. So one of those is there's a lot of financial fraud that has been gone on in and out of like Phoenix as like a, I don't know, haven for people to do like weird financial stuff. You know, those commercials where it's like not applicable in New Jersey, like Phoenix is becoming that new like loophole for some weird shit. So because of that, these people that would sign these contracts to rent these instruments, they actually weren't liable. So, like, I would have to go and be like, cool, well, if you don't pay, it's bad debt in your name. People would be like, are you going to collect? And I'd be like, yeah, you got to call the office. Because I knew the answer is like, no, we have no right to collect.
Huh.
We have a right for me to show up and be like, give us our money. But after that, that's it.
And then, yeah, basically it's like whether they do or not is kind of their option.
Yeah, exactly. Because of the nature of like how, yeah, something about the nature of how they were structured as a financial entity. Like they weren't, it wasn't a loan. We're not loaning you this money and then taking that loan to buy this instrument. We're basically loaning you this instrument on good faith that you're going to pay for it.
Right.
Yeah. So I got to see a lot of the Phoenix Valley. I mean, I was all over the place, which in some ways was cool. I like traveling. I like checking out, you know, this rock that we live on. But I saw a lot of shit that was just in direct conflict of anything that I viewed as like my way of life being a New Englander.
Right.
It was sideways, man. I had some very, very fucked up shit happen.
Honestly, like what you're describing with the developments, it actually reminds me of what we saw when we went to Egypt, which is just like, it's basically like unregulated government to the extent that no one can drink the water, like even the rich people, you know what I mean? Yeah. And like the whole city is half built, you know, and when you're in Cairo, like you just drive for miles and miles down the highway between the airport and the pyramids of Giza, and it's just buildings that are not finished. And they intentionally don't finish building them because if the building, they don't get taxed for the building until it's done being built. Mm-hmm. So they just have like half finished buildings that people are living in.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, so this is not going to work.
I spent a bunch of time in Romania as a teenager. My oldest brother, his wife's actually Romanian. And so we had gone a couple of times when I was a teenager. So before he met his wife, this was like family missionary trip type shit. And so, that was my first world experience seeing stuff like that. And there they build a lot of just concrete form buildings. I mean, yeah. You know, everything, the whole structure is just poured concrete. And so they would do that. They would be unfinished and it could be like a wall that's just plastic so that the building is not finished.
Right.
And then people are living there and it's wow. Like, oh man, when are they going to finish that? They're never going to finish it because it's taxed differently.
Yeah.
That was the first time I had seen that on like any sort of scale, hundreds of these, you know, unfinished structures that are yeah. fully inhabited. But in Arizona, it was different because it was like, I felt so bad for these people that like this was before like this. So I was there before the financial crisis.
Right.
And, it was weird. You know, we had some family friends that, we're trying to get my mom to like invest in like Phoenix property, you know, hey, we're building this 120 townhouse, you know, development. And so my mom asked me while I was out there, I was like, don't fucking do it, dude. You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
Like, you're burning your money. There's no way. And I felt bad for these people that ended up living there. Cause I mean, it was like Nightmare on Elm Street shit. Like there'd be a couple of families living there with kids, you know, they're trying to have a nice home, trying to have a nice life. And like, there's a 80 vacant framed semi-completed structures that vagrants are now in.
Yeah.
And like you drive through this creepy area cause the plot you bought is in the back. Cause you know, like it was so fucked up.
And just, yeah.
Having not just one, but, you know, 200, 300, 400 of those experiences.
Wow.
Or I'm just like, man, like what?
This place.
What
sucks.
Is our country doing? Because yeah. I had traveled our country a little bit, like as a kid, but like as a kid.
Yeah, you don't have the same like analytical abilities. Like when you're a kid, you think everything's normal.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing it all for the first time. You're like, yeah. Gosh,
and if some, and if an adult's not like, hey, that's kind of weird, you're never like, oh, that's.
And even if they were, you wouldn't understand why. You
know? Yeah, that place was shit. I was not a fan of that place at all. Sans my schooling and right. learning opportunities.
So then after 2 years there, you come right back?
No, actually, I thought I would. Like, I thought I would just go and learn some skills that I would then come back and make some records with friends
yeah.
and... you know, maybe work at a bar or maybe do some carpentry or just whatever.
Like yeah.
I had no sort of vision for this being a career path. And so, you know, in school, a lot of the teachers are, you know, current working professionals, you know, some very well regarded, awarded, you know, professionals. So, you know, it's a very structured school program. And towards the end, you know, they had these, 16 week periods called cycles, you know, and so you complete these 10 cycles. And so by the time you're in cycle 8 or 9, they're like, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? What kind of, you know, do you want to do film? Do you want to do live sound? Do you want to do studio? Do you want to do post-production? Like, do you want to do sports casting? Like what turns you on? You know,
right.
You want to make records. What do you want to make? Goth, jazz, you know, folk, what are you into?
Right.
and so, I had befriended this intern, counselor, placement counselor, day one, at his advisement that, you know, you meet the faculty day one and, this, you know, intern advisor was like, hey, I'm Dave, get to know me. I'm the dude that's going to help, you know, pick your needle in a haystack for you, try to find a place you want to work, get to know me. By the way, I'm doing a stand-up comedy show tomorrow night at this place. I was like, I'm fucking go there and buy that dude a beer. And I did. I was the only kid. Showed up. I was like, what's up, Dave? He was funny. He was like a Chris Farley kind of dude. And he was a funny stand-up. And he's like, who are you? What are you all about? Let's talk. Cool. 2 weeks later, he was like, hey, you want to do an internship? Like, the band The Gin Blossoms owned a studio in town. So nice. He was like, you know, one of their interns is going to be done in two cycles. So in, you know, 30 weeks or whatever, or 22 weeks, I think it actually was. you know, do you want to get in on this shit? You know, rather than them passing on to somebody else, you know, you grabbing an internship, something else. He's like, this would be cool. It's a cool studio. So he hooked me up with them. So I interned for them the whole time. So I learned a lot. They actually physically rebuilt a lot of their studio during the time that I was there, which is cool because I got to see and help and watch. And
you get to see that happen pretty earlier in your education.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, go to school, get out of school, get stoned, go drive around, repo some instruments, come back, do a late night shift at the studio, whether I'm cleaning or assisting or just there trying to learn my own shit. You know, hey, I learned this at school today. Let's fuck with this compressor, you know. And then they were remodeling it, so I did a lot of that. As I was getting towards the end, I was encouraged to, you know, go apply, go get a job. And so I applied to a bunch of internships. I was kind of mad. You know, I was 24 at the time and, you know, had done all these hours of internship and, you know, had like a 3.9 and was kind of like, I'm not going to go intern. I want to, now that you're telling me to go get a job, job to me means money.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go get a job. So the director of the school set me up with an internship in Los Angeles at a very prestigious studio. And you have to take a test to even get an interview for this internship. And, you know, so, you know, submitted that and, you know, they do follow up questions. And basically, you know, what they offered is, you know, you come for 2 years and you're unpaid and you're on call. And so I simply just asked, well, how do I do that? How do I afford that? How do I get a job and make any amount of money and do this thing? And they were like, you don't take out a loan, have your family help you. I'm like, I don't have any of those fucking options. Right. So, you know, it was an amazing studio. I mean, just multi-million dollar, you know, facility that does platinum records every day type shit. So I couldn't, it just wasn't attainable.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do it. And it, you know, it was an interest to me because these were rooms that I was gawking over for the last 2 years in school, looking at it. What is their gear? What is their aesthetic? What is their arrangement? What are they built for? What kind of music are they doing? What are their records sound like? You know, what are these rooms? So, so I balked at it. I was like, there's no way I can do that. And so I'm, you know, complaining to the director of the school, like, well, what do I do? He's like, just go apply and get a job at like a mid-level studio somewhere. Okay. Start applying. You know, applied maybe 25, 30 places all in California. Because he was like, where are you going to go? I was like, I'm going to go home. Go to New Hampshire. He's like, are there studios there? I was like, yeah, there's one. He's like, then don't go there. Because unless you know that dude and you're going to work there, don't go there.
Right.
Oh, okay. He's like, go to New York, go to California, you know, maybe Austin, maybe, you know, Chicago, maybe Miami. I was like, I'm not interested in any of those. I'm already here. I don't want to go back to New England winters yet. California is 10 hours that way. So, all right, I'll look in California. So I applied to like 25, 30 places and this couple of people hit me back and, you know, had some follow-ups, had some phone interviews. And then this one kooky dude was just like, I want to hire you for 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. This guy had this old client, this old rich right-wing dude that had booked every Monday, Wednesday, Friday in perpetuity in this studio. And this guy, Justin, couldn't handle it anymore, but he wanted his money. He just didn't want to sit in the chair with him. So he hired me. Hey, man, I'll give you these 3 days, $28 an hour. I'm like, done deal. I'll move to California and check it out. So I did, and that was my first gig, and I mostly did that for, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months, and then, you know, go hand out business cards, go meet people, go see shows. You know, hey, I have access to this studio. Like, let's do something besides this dude's thing.
What was his thing? Just like,
so
it's like spoken word.
No. This guy actually had a very, very interesting life or career, I guess. So, His name is Jimmy Jolie. He's probably like 82 or something like that now. So he wrote that song, Let's Dance, that like Bowie did and shit. So he wrote that and had this dude, Chris Montez, do it in 1962. So he wrote it. He paid for it. He had the record made. He was like 20-something at the time. And it did okay. It was like, you know, whatever, number four or five or something in the country. And he made a little bit of money on it. And he actually co-financed the first Beatles U.S. Tour. So basically promoters that put the tour together ended up being bankrupt in the 11th hour. Like, how do we pay for the last X, Y, and Z? So a couple of dudes like Jim came in and put a bunch of money on the table, and then they did all right. And then because of that, like, you know, that rub, that sort of payola, if you will, they went back and they pumped this record in the UK. And so then 2 years later, that Let's Dance became number one in the UK, and this guy Jim made a shitload of money off it because he owned it. He was like the first dude to own his own masters.
Wow.
At ever, you know, like otherwise it was all label, however small, you know, the label always owned it, whatever. So, that was like 1965, I believe, maybe 66. Cause the story he told me was that basically from 1969 on, he's made over $100,000 in royalties on just that song. And wow. There have been years it's been more, you know, so he's had other business endeavors for most of his life. He's a real estate developer. So basically since 1969, he's made this money on this song, and he spends every penny of the money that comes in on that song making more music.
Hmm.
So he spent probably $200,000 on this record that we did. And he brought in just insane people. Like, he brought in this guy, Barry, who's a cello player, works with Ravi Shankar and does all of Ravi Shankar's string arrangements. Like when they had the concert for George Harrison when he died, this guy Barry did all the arrangements, you know, for the string players. So he lived pretty close to us. So we hired him and we went to, you know, this crazy studio in Oakland and, you know, recorded this, you know, six-part, you know, symphony piece. And he hired like Disney voice actors to like come in and do like weird voices in these tunes. So he like went full on into the rabbit hole of these tunes. So it was all singer songwriter. The project started with three acoustic guitar players plugged in DI sitting in a room, sort of singing campfire style with these tunes that Jim had. Then they would record these three acoustic guitars and then they would just build, they'd get a form and then they would just build. And by the end, most of the acoustic would be stripped out, sans one, being Jim's, and it would all be replaced with everything under the sun, you know, percussive players, horn players, string players, you know, other singers, voice actors, sound effects shit. Like, I got paid $2,000 over the course of a month to recreate the helicopter noise from Apocalypse Now because he was so adamant that we couldn't steal or sample that helicopter noise that I was like, who fucking cares? Nobody's ever going to know. There's this song about some dude in Vietnam and nobody's going to know that it's right. From Apocalypse Now, period. I could slow it down. I could pitch it. I was like, nobody's going to fucking know. Nope. So he paid me and I recreated a sound by like actually licensing for $10, the helicopter noise and then processing it and then adding the background jungle crunch, you know, like,
right.
I didn't care. I did shit like, you know, shit like that. It's like, you're going to pay me to sit at home and tinker with this.
Right.
Okay. Sure. But yeah, then it branched out to just other studios. So it was weird because like I worked for the Jim Blossoms and they wanted me to stay in Arizona and I was fucking over Arizona in the worst way. I couldn't get out of there fast enough when school was done. So I was like, thanks, but no thanks. I'm not fucking staying here. But I had become really good friends with the singer, this guy, Robin Wilson. You know, him and I were buddies, you know, at that point. So he was like, hey man, I'm really buddies with this guy, Greg Camp, who's the songwriter, guitar player for Smash Mouth. He's like, you know, you got this job, you're going to Santa Cruz. He lives in Santa Cruz. You should fucking call him up. So I'm like, all right, cool. So I call him up and, you know, I get there and I'm like, hey, you know, did Robin tell you I was calling? He's like, yeah, dude. Yeah, I just quit the band and I'm suing him for $55 million. So I got nothing for you. Okay, cool.
Plus, your bleach blonde hair is reminding me of that asshole singer.
No, I was well past that phase of my life. I have not gone back.
I have an embarrassing passport photo from college where I had bleach blonde hair and a chin beard, and it.
Does my chin beard offend you?
No, it's like a full like Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. And I look just like the fucking guy from Smash Mouth.
If you don't know, he's a horrible human being.
I believe it.
I'm not afraid to say that. Absolute pile of shit. So I go about my thing. I work at this studio called Bear Creek. Other engineers and musicians are coming in. I start getting pulled to these other rooms. So I'm going up to Oakland and San Jose and, you know, these other places and making contacts or whatever. And then I had been there for like a year and a half, maybe just about 2 years. Started doing some film stuff, some TV stuff. So I was loving it. I'm like, fuck, I'm doing all this shit, you know, like this is cool. This is all cool. And then Greg from Smash Mouth called me up and was like, hey man, you know, I got some technical difficulties in my studio. Do you want to come take a look, help me out, maybe hang out? Sure. Okay. So I just like roll up in this industrial park and this unassuming, you know, 6,000 square foot building and just walk in and meet him. And he's kind of shy and bashful and we start talking and hanging out. I'm like, what the fuck is this building? And, oh, this is where we housed all the shit when we toured. You know, three tractor trailers would come and offload all this stuff. And, I mean, every single Fender guitar you could ever imagine, every single Fender amp ever imagined, they were sponsored. So Greg had, he had one or more of everything, you know, just so many toys. So we hung out that first night for like 12 hours. You know, got buzzed, laughed, listened to music, just talked, you know, like just hit it off. You know, I was like, man, you're a cool dude. So he was like, yeah, I need some help. I'm trying to like hook up my studio. So I started helping him. And then I was like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, you've got vintage equipment sitting on the ground next to like empty Tecate cans that you're ashing out cigarettes in.
Sure.
Like, what are we doing here? Like, cause I'm, you know, trying to hold back my, you know, my fabric boner for this audio equipment that's here. I'm just like, fuck, what are we doing, man? So, I basically was like, man, I got all these clients now and I'm scattered everywhere and I'm running to this studio and that studio. And like, you're trying to get me to do shit and you're kind of bummed out that I can't be here certain days or whatever. I was like, let's do this. Let's fucking make this a studio. Let's do it. We can do all your music and I can bring all my clients here and I can help you pay the $2,900 fucking overhead that you have. Cause it was fucked up. He was like suing Smash Mouth this whole time. And so we were, you know, working on his solo music. He did a solo record. And so, amidst all of that, he ended up like, rejoining the band. Cause essentially in the end of the lawsuit, the judge basically was like, you're never going to get this money back unless the entity starts receiving more money and you can therefore restructure where the money goes. But if there's no money coming in to this business, you will never get a penny. So it was really fucked up because Steve Harwell, the singer and the manager, you know, they embezzled tens and tens of millions of dollars on the stupidest rock star shit you can imagine. Like Steve built a NASCAR and fucking crashed it. And they don't insure NASCARs. So just lit, you know, $2-3 million on fire.
Jesus.
You know, fucked up a boat similarly, you know, like multi-million dollar yacht, you know, like stupid shit, you know?
Yeah.
So here's Greg now, like got a family, got a new wife, like, you know, I need some means to live.
Right.
Like they were, their story's kind of fucked up and it's really indicative of, what I think is the old era of record companies where they became famous overnight. You know, Carson Daly played that song and it just blew up overnight, where literally record labels were like jamming contracts down their throat. When that happened, Steve and the manager just wrote the shadiest contract they could in their favor. And so here's Greg and the other guys, you know, drummer and bass player. They were, you know, our age, regular jobs. Greg was working in a picture framing place. And it's like, here's an advancement of fucking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
So it's like, don't ask. Sure, let's do it.
Right.
Let's go do this. And, you know, Greg lived a simple life. You know what I mean? Like, sure, he had some things that maybe other people don't have, but there was nothing lavish about the life that he led, you know? Whereas Steve and the manager were like, let's ride a stretch Hummer everywhere we go. Let's fucking...
Right. I want a fucking camel.
Yeah, exactly. I want to eat sushi off of naked fucking ETs, you know, like whatever.
I want sushi made out of ET.
Yeah. So that was weird because then they rejoined and started doing shit to like make money.
Right.
So I went along and did a bunch of like these... you know, a couple live show things with them and you know, touring is not the right word, but they would do one off, two off, three off days, yeah, things. Yeah. And it was fucking awful. And the whole time, you know, Greg has this new wife and here I am, like, you know, I considered myself a really good friend to him, you know, at the time. And I'm like, man, like, fuck these people. Like, just get the fuck out. Like, this is toxic. You know, and Steve was just a douche. I mean, he had stolen all this money and had the audacity to act like a fucking clown in the same room as these people, you know, every show they did.
Yeah.
It's just like, dude, like, what are you fucking doing, dude?
Yeah.
You know, are you kidding me? You know, he didn't drink or do drugs. Supposedly he would drink like 36 Red Bulls a day. I mean, can you imagine what any human being
can
is like?
Can you imagine what his pee smelled like?
No, I cannot. Yeah, so I mean, I did that, you know, and continued to work at some other studios, but had sort of built this studio, which we called C-Volt, sort of as my thing, and was doing some records there. And then through some life events, made the decision to come back here. Which I thought was going to be temporary, like maybe a year, maybe two. But I came back and I now have a child here. So, and just signed a very long lease. So, I mean,
when was that?
I came back in 2008.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and then not long thereafter must have started the place in Rollinsford, right?
Yeah, man. I came back. I had taken a job. I was actually very oddly full circle. Basically, my brother was sick, and so I was coming back to like see him every month. And at the same time, started seeing this gal long distance, who's you know, my mother's son. And so I was seeing my brother and seeing her. And so after two or three of these trips, I reached out to Chris Thunder Sky, and I was like, "Hey, I'm going to keep coming back for at least the next few months, like." Can I do some work there? Do you have work for me? Can I try to fish up clients? Can I try to make some money while I'm there? Because if I can make a little bit, I could justify being here longer. So I sort of started doing that dance for a couple of months, and I did a few sessions there. And he was like, "Hey, man, like, do you want to work here?" And at first, I'm like, "No, dude, I live in California. I've got kind of a cool thing going. Thanks, but no thanks." And then my brother's health looked bleak, so I didn't want to come home for a funeral, you know? So I didn't know the outcome. He was battling some cancer, so I didn't know like what the outcome was going to be. So I made the decision like, I'm dating this girl. My brother is approaching possible end of the line. This guy's offering me a job. Okay. This universe is saying I should come home. And so I did, and I took a job at Thundering Sky, and then, you know, by the time I made the decision to move, I was like, all right, I need like 90 days to wrap everything up here. So I'm not coming home for the next 90 days. Cool. See everybody in 3 months. So I did that, moved cross country in September, 08. And then, you know, immediately after November, financial crisis happened and, you know, the bottom drop. Chris didn't have any work. And I didn't have a client basis here. So it's not like I had work to fall back on.
Right.
So I started cutting trees for this tree company that I had worked for before. Shout out to Michael Davis. What up? Cornerstone Tree Cut.
Mad Various Finest.
Sorry about that, folks. So, I mean, it was crazy because he was booming and I needed work. I had idle time. I was applying everywhere. I was applying at studios in Boston, in Portland, in New York, and I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And my brother got better. He had a full recovery. And so, now here I am dating this girl, no job, my brother's health is fine, I just moved 3,000 miles, what the fuck am I doing?
Right.
I have this apartment full of gear, I have zero clients, let's drink, let's just drown my sorrows. So I did, I mean, I was pretty depressed for, I don't know, 3-4 months, just like, I'm working in the winter, I'm outside in New England snow, I'm fucking cutting trees, I'm around loud, dangerous shit, like, I have now backpedaled in life. by 10 years.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, I mean, I got negative. I got really dark. I got really negative. You know, I'd come home and I'm going to eat my dinner. I'm going to drink 3 to 6 beers. I'm going to go to bed, repeat, you know.
Yeah. Not to mention, I mean, not to be like, not to like oversimplify it, but like your first New England winter in a while, like it can depress anyone, you know, never mind like having been away from it for a while, you know, you come back and it's just
Yeah. I mean, like the first year I was in Arizona, I didn't come back because I was in school and, you know, I didn't have money, you know, I didn't have recreational funds. And so I didn't come back the first year, you know, I did the second, and I refused to wear a winter coat. So I showed up like this, a couple sweatshirts, whatever. I was like, fuck that. I'll be chilly. All I got to do is walk from a door to a car. I'm not going to hang out outside, you know? And then when I was in California, I treated it the same way. Like, I'm not getting boots. I don't care if my feet get wet a little bit. I'm not buying boots for, you know, 5 days that I'll be there. So I treated it very much like that. And then moved home and it was like, cool. You're going to wear 6 pairs of long underwear and 8 scarves and then get up at crack of dawn and go do hard manual labor in sub-zero temperatures. But I mean, in some ways it was good, you know, like it was, I wouldn't say I was like arrogant about my career path. I was really excited about what had happened in those first 4 or 5 years for me. But I definitely got dark. Like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
There's nobody here to make records with. This is bullshit. Like, you know, am I mad at myself? Am I mad at my brother? Am I mad at my girlfriend? Am I mad at, you know, the studio that fizzled, you know, like, you know, sort of trading responsibility of these negative feelings. And then I just, you know, I was like, okay, I'm here. You know, my girlfriend was in grad school at the time. I was like, I'm here. I'm just going to build a studio. Like, I'm mad that I don't have a room to work in. Nobody's going to show up tomorrow and be like, hey, Chris, you want that job that you really like?
Right.
So I was like, fuck it. I'm going to do this thing. And it was an absolute leap of faith. I mean, I had zero money. You know, I had a very small nest egg to begin. And then every week I'd get a paycheck from the tree service thing and be like, all right, half goes to Chris Chase's life bills and half goes to fucking 2x4s and sheetrock and shit. So it was almost out of like self-preservation necessity. Like,
yeah.
You know,
if you build it, they will come.
That's 100%.
Like, it's not out there. So
yeah.
What other choice do you have?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's, you know, it's a similar position that I'm in now where, I mean, I was out. Like, I, you know, it had been a year, you know, circling back to like your first question or whatever. Yeah, it had been 6 months rather, that I had been looking every day and I was broke and I wasn't nearly at all as dark, and by any stretch of the imagination as I had been the first time. But I was doubly frustrated, you know, because I had an opposite problem. I had clients. I had people that wanted to do creative things with me, and they were people that I wanted to work with, and now I don't have a place to do that.
Right.
So, you know, it was rough. It was hard to figure out, like, okay, where do I do this? What do I sacrifice? Do I build a shitty studio here tomorrow because it's accessible, or do I keep looking, you know? And then the path got too drawn out and hard that I was like, all right, I can't do this.
Yeah.
I've lived off of whatever I've saved. Now I'm broke. So I'm broke. How do I build a studio? You know, so I had sort of made the decision like, all right, now the universe is not giving me a pathway.
Yeah.
So I'm out. And you know, I started photographing and inventorying my equipment and sort of calculating in my mind, like, what do I sell? How many years do I buy myself of time? I live very simply. Christopher Chase lives off of very few pennies. I've basically poured all of my money into 1130 Feet, the old business, and now Noise Floor, the new business. So I know what Chris Chase can live off of meagerly, but... No, I was calculating, like, okay, if I pull the plug, what does it do for me? Do I buy myself 1, 2, 3 years that I can reinvent the wheel and hope that I can get a new income stream and a new thing? And I was talking to some people in different job sectors and trying to think about what would make me happy. And I came to the realization several times in my own head. I'm like, all right, dude, I'm this full-time dad. You know, my kid's in kindergarten now, so... I have a major responsibility to my son. If I go sell insurance or, you know, work as a, you know, graphic designer or something like that, at some point I'm going to be drunk and dark about this thing that I yearn to do.
Right.
And so, you know, I was like crossing the threshold of like, oh, this is the best decision for my kid is to hang it up, sell everything, reinvent the wheel. But at the same time, that seems short term to me because, you know, by the time he's 8 or 11, is dad going to hate his life? Because I get up and sell insurance every day, you know?
Totally.
Call it life, synchronicity, whatever. I had made the decision. I had told my mom, yeah, I'm out, mom. You know, she's one of my best friends. And she was like, if you're telling me, you've already made that decision. I'm like, yeah, yep. She's like, how come you didn't talk to me about it before? I'm like, because I knew what I needed to do. And it's not something I'm proud of, but I got to do this. And then, you know, she's like, oh, nothing else on the horizon. I'm like, no, I'm going to look at one property tomorrow, but it's not going to happen. Why not? Well, it's far out of my price range. So, well, why are you going to look at it? Because it's right down the street. So, fuck it. I'll spend a half hour of my time and check it out. And I did. And that ended up being the spot, you know.
Wow.
The dude gave me the keys within 7 minutes, which I'm just standing there like, he doesn't know this backstory of like, I've given up hope.
Yeah.
This is over. You know, here's this dude, this eccentric local yokel, whom I love dearly now. I did not know how to read him 8 months ago when we first crossed paths. I was like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, what? You just met me. We've been in the same room for 7 minutes. You don't want my money, but you've forced these keys into my hand.
Isn't that kind of perfect, though, that, like, you would have to reach that point of, like, I'm done. Like, I've done as much as I possibly can do. Like, why are you still going to this place? I don't know. It's right there. I may as well. You know? And that, like, it's so dramatic. It's so like a storybook kind of a turn to say, like, yeah, I'm just like, I've seen a zillion places, and like, I don't know, that when you finally reach that point of giving up, the universe, you know, the universe provides, you know.
It's, yeah, just like, it's totally. And it's funny because this somewhere along the way, I ended up, because I was driving around. Like, I would bring my kid to preschool, and then I would, let's go drive around every fucking side street in every town and look for the little guy that has the handwritten for rent shit.
Right.
I was specifically looking for a standalone building, or at least a building that didn't have a neighbor above. I mean, that was a major component into the demise of the last place.
And neighbor above that was rolling giant pegs with stuff.
Exactly.
I worked at North Country for a couple of months before I got this job. And it wasn't until I read the article about the opening of the new studio that I knew that it had anything to do with the closure of the old studio. That's a bummer.
I mean, it's not really, I mean, no offense, his lop. I mean, it's true. It's a little kernel factoid for sure. But those guys were super cool. Like, you know, when I realized that they were up there and what they were doing, I mean, I just went up and was like, hey, I have no ego, and you're doing a much more robust and professional thing than I am. I'm just making music, buddy. You know, I was like, but I'd love for you to come down and see like what is directly underneath this. And they, you know, both, you know, Silas and Ivan came down, and they're like, whoa, holy shit, what the fuck? We play music. We love music. Holy shit. You know, and they were super cool. And it was, I had to have zero ill will towards them because, I was in this standoff with the property manager. We had been in this feud for years, I'll put it, where we were both sticking to our guns and sticking it to each other in one way or another. And so he now had fulfilled 6 years, and he was trying to change the operating terms of what it would have taken for me to stay at the same time that these guys were sort of presenting a nuisance. You know, not them as a nuisance, but just there were some issues at hand.
Right.
So I used that, or tried to use that, as bargaining power with the property owner to be like, hey, man, I built this place. I put all this money into this place. I can't use it now. it's built for this thing. Good luck having anything else be used in this weird shaped cave right. that I've made. I'm going to leave. I was trying to call his bluff. And it ended up working out for the better because had I had continued that lease and tried to mitigate those factors, Sue's space opened up next door.
Yeah.
So either I would have been a curmudgeon to them and put my foot down with Brian, or you know, maybe they wouldn't have moved in the first place. You know, who knows? You know,
right.
So I wouldn't certainly wouldn't have ended up at my space, you know, that I'm at now. So yeah, I never at all like, you know, waved a finger or like, damn you guys. It was actually more like, oh cool, this is a thing that I'm never going to try and change, which is great because it makes my decision easier,
right?
For this, you know.
Well, and it's also like kind of easier in hindsight to be like, oh, as a result of this thing and this thing and this thing, like, how did we get to where we are now? But in the present tense, it's just sort of like, oh, all right, now what do we do?
Yeah.
You know? Well, it's really cool that through all of those, like shitty coincidences, but also, like, weird serendipity, that you're landed in a spot where you can look back and be like, oh, wow, like, you can draw the, like, crazy map all the way across the country and back of like the decisions that were made that led to you ending up where you are now.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, everyone can do that, but it's like, it's cool to recognize those moments and be like, oh yeah, this like happenstance thing that came out of my mouth to a high school teacher who I don't even remember the name of,
yeah.
like ended up like defining the rest of my life with all these like stops along the way. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, totally. And it's funny because like in the old place, 1130 feet, I was able to, you know, my goal going to school was like, I just want to learn how to do this like with buddies. And
yeah.
And at some point in the 5.5 years I was cutting records there, you know, each of the members of bands, these two bands that I had been in before going to school, I'd recorded them all separately within other projects. But like by the time I was in and out of that place, you know, I had fulfilled that. I had done it with these people that were friends and bandmates that were part of the inspiration of like when I left to do this. You know, it's so fucked up because like I was practicing with one of these bands in the Rollinsford Mill, in the Upper Mill, far left hand side as you come around the corner to South Berwick. And there was a couple bands sharing the space, and then this guy Jeff Landrock came in. And we were all getting noise complaints because we were all doing shit all the time. It was, you know, it was this communal space. And so basically somebody was doing something all the time. So we ended up building this room to sort of encapsulate, you know, a room like this size to encapsulate like the band when we practiced, you know, so this room within a room. And then Jeff ended up using it as this studio and one of the other bands left. And then shortly after I left to go to school, you know, the band disbanded and then Jeff sort of took it off and running and made that his full-time gig was this recording studio. And then he left there and moved into what is Sue's space now.
Yeah.
And, he didn't build it. The previous tenant had built it the way that it is, but he occupied it for a number of years. When he moved out, John Nolan moved in and took his old space and had Milltown, recordings going out of there. And then a year later I showed up and built next to Jeff. And Jeff was one of the, Jeff was the first person to ever record me. And then I went to Thundering Sky and recorded with Chris a couple times, and then went back to Jeff and then did some stuff at a studio in Manchester. So yeah, it was like my first year back. It was weird. Cause like I was here, I didn't think I'd ever end up back here. Now, like there's these, you know, familiar faces that I had sort of brushed shoulders with years ago. Now, like, man, there's this community, there's this thing. And so, yeah, my sense of like what this area, artistry, community, small town, you know, vibe, it set in really quickly. Like, oh, this is cool. This actually feels like home.
Right.
You know, like this, I enjoyed I hated Arizona. The people were weird, a lot of shit about it. I liked California. For most of the time I was there, I liked a lot of things about it, but there were some things that I didn't dig as a New Englander, I guess. So when I came back, begrudgingly almost, was like, oh man, this actually feels like home. Like this is cool.
Yeah.
I could see myself being here, I guess, forever. You know?
It's nice. It's really nice. And especially when you like, you don't realize that you feel that way. And then you come back and it kind of takes you by surprise. And you're like, oh, yeah, I guess I am from here.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it is built into me in a way that, you know, when you're growing up, you're rebelling against everything. So you're just like, fuck everything, fuck everyone. And then you come back and you're like, oh, I love those fucking everyone's.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody's journey in life is different. And I mean, you know, I had a lot of growing up to do as an adolescent. I think a lot of kids struggle with their teenage years of just sense of identity, sense of self.
That's what it's for.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you know, I mean, I had that, you know, total, you know, dramatic, like you were saying, you know, when I left for Arizona was like, you know, driving into the sunset alone in my Volkswagen Golf packed to the brim, like, where am I going? What am I doing? Who am I trying to be? Mm-hmm. What do I want? You know, like having those conversations that I guess maybe I had, but maybe I hadn't allowed myself to have fully until I was in that car behind the wheel. Like, fuck, I'm going. I'm scared.
Yeah.
What am
I
doing? You know, and I had a whole bunch of fucked up shit happen literally on my drive cross country. And then my years in Arizona where it was like, you know, I had to grow up in a different way. I'm here. I'm alone. I don't have my mom or my best buds or, you know, coworkers that I have rapport with or things like that, you know? So, you know, it's part of growing up. And I mean, I would encourage more people, especially like even younger kids, like, you know, take a year off, plan a year off in your life. I mean, that's something that we don't do in America.
Yeah.
We just had, I was living with Nick Phaneuf for a couple of years, you know, a good buddy, and he's one of the partners at the studio. And, they had traveled the world, have traveled the world quite a bit. And so they have some connections. And one of them is, they have some family and friends, and overseas. And so this kid, Julian, came, he's Dutch. And so they do what's called a gap year, you know, it's planned and go apprentice, go intern, go travel, go do whatever. And so, you know, he came and spent about 7 months here and, I think it's valuable.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for me, the time that I spent, maybe, you know, I have some regrets in life, not a lot, but, maybe, you know, I wouldn't have done 4 years. Maybe I would have done one or two with a better plan or vision for the time off, but you know, whatever it happened,
yeah,
you know, organically. But I think that, I don't know, maybe it's like, I don't know if it's just the arts or what. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's beneficial to anybody. Like, who do you want to be? Take a step back, go dip your toes in that. Is that right for you? Do you get turned on or turned off by that? Do you want to commit to debt or 10, you know, what you feel is 10 or 20 years you have to commit to this path or this career? Like, I mean, I don't, you know, maybe some people just wake up and know, like, damn it, I'm going to be a CPA. And that's,
right,
that's what I want to, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, I've never had, the only thing I've ever felt of that is like, yeah, I want to keep making records.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
I don't want a real job, you know?
Well, I mean, but honestly, like you probably more than a lot of people like figured out what you wanted to do early on. Like it's almost like a surprisingly mature and adult career path to have decided as a teenager, like, yeah, this is what I want to do. And then to have like put in all those steps of hard work and like knowledge building to actually become that thing. You know, I still feel like I haven't like figured out like what I am. I've just sort of happened into all of these different jobs and it's like a career path kind of chose me, you know, but I don't know. I think it's cool that you figured it out, even if you were just saying it offhandedly and then like, have made it happen over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, for the record, I have not figured it out. I have,
no.
I have no like, fucking clue what I'm doing.
Yeah, but, you know, but...
But I'm doing it. I mean, yes. You know, it's weird, man, because, like, I, you know, throughout all of this, you know, you know, 12 years or so that I've been doing this, like, I mean, I don't have an ego. I've met and worked with some people that have, you know, accolades and all that jazz, and I'm just a dude, you know, you're just a dude. I don't care, you know, how famous you are. Like you're still a person, you know? And I've had people, you know, say to me, you know, this, you're so inspirational, or, you know, oh man, this is amazing. Or, you know, it's like, I don't take compliments well. Like, I just kind of feel like there's no need for that.
Right.
But then to me, it's like, I just, you know, I don't view myself as like, yeah, I am gifted, guys, and look at me. It's like, well, this was necessity. Like, you don't understand. Like, no offense to you or you or you, like, I can't go and do your job.
Right.
Like, I simply wouldn't get out of bed if that was what I had to do. And, I don't know what, you know, whatever it is about me, you know, being as attached to music as I am. I mean, I've thought about being an adult more and like, oh, I should do something that has a 401k,
right,
or built-in benefits. And like, okay, well, what do? I have this associate's degree in this thing. People are like, well, why don't you go be a, you know, a builder, a contractor? You know, this place is amazing. It's like, well, that's cool. Unless you want to pay me to build another studio for me, I don't want to fucking do this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I love that work. I love being a craftsman momentarily. Like, this is this.
Well, as a means to an end. Yeah.
Yeah. But even like in a smaller sense, like, you know, I built furniture and it's like, oh man, I want a piece of furniture. I go to IKEA or I go online. I'm like, I don't want to buy particle board shit. Okay. So I'm going to build that thing. I'm excited about building that thing and it works out and it's functional. And now I've solved that problem. Cool. I love that. Somebody's like, I want you to build a piece of furniture. It's like, no, I don't do that. That's not what I do.
Right.
And even if I did, I wouldn't know how or feel comfortable charging you for that. Right. Cause I'm not a furniture maker. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if I said, do you like your shoes? You want to make me a pair of shoes? You know, it's like, well, no, you know, I don't know. Yeah. It's, I mean, but the one thing I do know about myself is I'm stubborn. I'm stubborn as shit. So the minute that I'm like, I guess I'm doing this, it's like, I mean, it just,
there's no turning back.
Yeah. There's no turning back for better or worse. I mean, like this is, you know, on paper, this is suicide. You know, like I spent an exorbitant amount of money and time, to build a thing that is a different thing than my last business. So there's no provable business model. There's no provable income stream to justify the upscaling of the process. I mean, it's, you know, it's a more of a hunch of like, again, no ego. It's like this place is cool. And, you know, I want to make records there. Like I walk into the room and I go, yeah, I want to make records here. Musicians that have walked in so far have responded the same way. I want, you know, a stable of 8, 10, 12 professional engineers and producers that feel exactly the same way. Like, hey, when I'm in the area or when I want to get out of New York, I'm going to go there and we could stay there and we'll spend 3, 4, 5, 6 days. We'll make a record. Like I want that to be the mold. And I think it's going to take some time to get the word out, you know, out of our area, out of this bubble. You know, not that I want out of it. I mean, there's a great community here.
But you fish from a larger pond.
Yeah. You know, just like you went to record with Steve, like, you know, there's kids out there that are still reading the back of CDs or they're looking at, you know, credits on Bandcamp. Like, what is this room? What is this guy?
And totally.
Like, you know, other engineers like, wow, that room, you know, I mean, shit, I buy a record. Holy shit. First thing I hear, if I hear a room sound, it's like, holy shit, where is this room?
Right.
You know, I mean, like that. That speaks to me, you know, volumes about like the character of the people, you know, people choose a place. My place isn't for everybody. My last place wasn't for everybody. Like just vibe me, you know, I'm not everybody's cup of tea as a person in my demeanor. I know that. But you know, people choose a place and a person and bandmates and, it's all part of the mosaic of the art that they're doing. So, I think it's cool. Not that my opinion, my opinion is biased, but, and B, not that it matters, but, it feels inspiring to me, which is, I think, you know, the core.
And it matters to the other people who also think it's cool. Like that's part of why they choose you and choose your space, you know, like saying like, I'm not for everybody or it's not for everybody. It's like, sounds like a euphemism for like, I'm a jerk or whatever, but it's like, no, nothing is for everybody.
Totally.
And like finding that match of a space and match of a producer is like special. Yeah. You know? So,
yeah, exactly. Cause you know, and yeah, everybody resonates differently. Everybody takes direction differently. I mean, I've never been on the other side of the glass from myself.
Right.
But I mean, I get a lot of positive feedback from people that I work with, but I mean, I'm a very direct person almost all of the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes to a fault where it just, I try to be diplomatic when that is needed, but otherwise, you know, if we have rapport or it is known that we're doing this thing or you've lifted the gate and said, please inform me whatever you feel, I'll just say whatever. And so, luckily it's been very, very, very few and far between, but you know, there have been musicians that just don't respond well to that. Which is fine because I've also been in a position where somebody comes through the door in a way that I'm like, oh fuck, I am not spending 10 hours with you, dude. Like,
right.
Holy shit. Why am I making your music? You
right.
know, luckily again, that has only happened, you know, unless I can count it on less than one hand, you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, yeah, everybody is not for everybody. So that's part of, you know, I built two rooms. There's an A and a B studio. I've got a couple of other engineers, that basically work out of there. So, you know, you have different genres, you have different skill sets. You know, some of these engineers are also musicians. They're also arrangers or composers, producers. You know, each one of them has their own, you know, I'm really good at jazz. I'm really good at punk rock. I'm really good at crafting singer-songwriters, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. And I like the idea of sort of building that stable and, you know, we got to get some records out of that room. Luckily, you know, like I said, we've started a couple of projects, but I think building that stable of people in the rooms and the sounds, I think it'll organically grow. And I mean, I would love to be facilities manager here too. Like I show up every day, 8 to 3:30 while my kid's in school. I make sure that room runs for whoever's in there being creative. You know, I don't care. I'll pick up burritos and clean the toilet and rewire the new pieces of hardware that we get and all yeah. that jazz like that. I'm totally cool with that because at some point I'm going to sit in the chair and produce a record for something right. that turns me on. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
So yeah, again, it probably looks like suicide on paper that we just did this wild and crazy thing. But, yeah, I mean, I feel pretty good about it. I mean, I'm broke, I'm stressed, I'm tired, but it's like, I did it to myself and I wouldn't change anything about it. You know?
Yeah.
I think that there will be, some good success, both creatively and financially, stability-wise, you know. So I'm feeling good about it.
Good.
Yeah.
So my final question for every guest is, if you could do one thing every day forever, what would it be?
Probably take a walk in the woods. It's a toss-up here between do I take that walk in the woods with just my dogs and sort of selfishly reflect, or do I have company and that company is either, you know, my son or whoever, you know, my mother or a friend or, you know, a romantic interest or something. Like, do I share that company? So I guess that would probably be my answer is like whatever, you know, my little nuclear family at the time is, whether it's, you know, the dude I'm producing a record with that day or my lover or my son or whatever, just myself. Take a walk in the woods and just like breathe and
yeah.
enjoy the stillness of the world around us. You know, I think we live in such a busy world that very few people, you know, stop to smell the roses. And to me, yeah. I don't give a shit about roses. I stop to smell the oak trees and shit. You know what I mean? Like, that is like, that's probably, it's weird because when I did the 5 spot with Hislop a couple years ago, you know, he asked, what's your favorite local place? And of course, I'm thinking of a watering hole or a restaurant or a nightclub. Mm-hmm. And immediately I was like, oh man, Von Woods. Like when I'm feeling high or I'm feeling low, man, go there and spend 60 to 120 minutes and just, you know, just let it go, you know. So it stood out in my mind like, oh, this is a really cool thing. So I guess I would go with that. Like take a walk with my dogs and, you know, whoever is around me at the time that I want to spend a couple hours in the woods with.
Yeah, may or may not be invited as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that was a good one, Chris.
Cool. Thanks for having me, man.
Thanks for coming over.
Yeah.